G'day. Michael Hart, who's not a Christian person, as an author, he wrote a book called The 100. And the book was about the 100 most influential people in history, in Michael Hart's estimation. And it was really interesting to me to learn that Jesus wasn't first, that first in Michael Hart's list was Muhammad, and then second in his list was Isaac Newton, father, I suppose, of the Enlightenment, modern science. And Jesus came third. And in his introduction, Michael Hart wrote why he didn't put Jesus first. And this is what he wrote. He said, "I am neither a Muslim nor a Christian. But on my observation, Muhammad has far more influence in the life of Muslims than Jesus does in the lives of Christians. And if believers simply took more notice of the teachings of Jesus, I would have absolutely no hesitation in placing him the most influential people in the the most influential person in the world." And needless to say, reading that is troubling. But I think that Michael Hart, as a non-Christian, is, I suppose, drawing our attention to, I mean, he wouldn't use these words, but to the mission of Christ, and to the need for Christians, for you and I, to have life and speech that's consistent with the gospel. Which leads us to our passage today, because in this remarkable passage, Paul will go to any lengths to ensure that his life and speech is consistent with the gospel and winsome for the gospel. Will go to any lengths, we see, to ensure that his life and speech is consistent with the gospel and winsome for the gospel. And just to trace where we're at, if we could just grab the map. In verse 1, I'll just stand down here. We start with Paul in Kos, just there, in verse 1 of chapter 21, and we trace him down to Rhodes and to Patara, just there. I'm very shaky. I think it's because of the big, thick coffee I had. And then verse 3, we trace him, and this is the end of his third missionary journey to Tyre. And at Tyre, he spends 7 days there, and he is prophesied over. It says in verse 4, through the Spirit, the Christians in Tyre were saying, "Don't go to Jerusalem." And this is very interesting, "Don't go." Then by land, he travels down to Ptolemais, where he stays with Stephen, and we've already met Stephen. Stephen was one of the seven who was chosen back in Acts chapter 6. And Stephen has four daughters, and they prophesy over Paul as well. He's there for 7 days. There's a warm farewell on the beach. And Paul travels south down to Caesarea. And down in Caesarea, I got that wrong actually, sorry. Caesarea is where he stays with Philip, and Philip has these four daughters that prophesy over him. But in Caesarea, you read in verse 7, we read this prophet Agabus. And Agabus we've already met in verse 11 of Acts. And Agabus had prophesied in verse 11 that a famine would come over the whole Roman Empire. He'd prophesied that and it came true. And now Agabus takes Paul's belt and he ties it around his own hands and his own feet. And Agabus says to everyone present, "Thus the Jews will do to the owner of this belt," which is Paul, "and they'll deliver him over to the Gentiles." When Agabus says that, he's using language that was used about the Jews delivering Jesus over to the Gentiles. And the response of the believers present was immediate. "Paul, you mustn't go to Jerusalem. You must stay here. Don't go to Jerusalem, Paul." And then Paul responds, if you just have a look there in verse 11, of Acts 21. Verse 13, "What are you doing," Paul says, "weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be imprisoned, but even to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." And that's very interesting. Paul doesn't know the details of what's going to happen in Jerusalem. Agabus doesn't give him the details of what will happen in Jerusalem, but he says, "I'm ready to die," and he goes. And I think it's worth even here just pausing. We read this a week ago at our Bible study on Wednesday night. And we're going through Acts as a Bible study. Miriam and Nick, Angela, Neerup, we've got a great Bible study. And someone said in our Bible study, Paul is so bold. Paul is so bold, so sure. And this story reminds me of a verse that was very significant to me as a young adult. Romans 1:16, there on the screen, where Paul writes in Romans 1:16, and it's worth jotting down on the front page of your Bible, I am not ashamed of the gospel. I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the salvation of God for everyone who believes, first for the Jew and also for the Greek. Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. And I take it, and I wouldn't have thought this back as a young adult, but I take it now that Paul knew that this is the true story of the world, that at the heart of reality is the Lordship of Christ, and he lived into that reality. And I've been thinking to myself the last couple of weeks, what does this mean to be bold and be sure in 2012? And it probably doesn't mean to go knocking on every door in our neighbourhood and saying, do you know Jesus? But what does it mean to be bold in 2012? Well, I think it means to live authentically into this truth, that at the heart of reality is the Lordship of Christ, and to speak accordingly and to act accordingly. And a story I shared with you, I think exactly 12 months ago, because we joined this church family 12 months ago, is a wonderful story of my friend Paul Little, who lives into this truth. He's a policeman. Policing in Australia is a rough culture. It's a crass culture. It's a tough culture. And Paul is a Christian. And he strives to live and speak winsomely in that context. He's a huge man. He's as tall as I am, and he's broad as he is tall. Unlike me in that regard. But it was Christmas Day, and he was rostered on, and no one wants to be rostered on Christmas Day. And so his wife, Narelle, also a friend of ours, cooks. She prepares a Christmas lunch, and he takes it to the police station for Christmas Day. It's a cold lunch in Australia because it's boiling hot. He took it to the police station, and the fellow officers offered to pay for the lunch. He said, no, it's my gift to you. And Paul said, you've got to imagine, he's a huge guy, a man of few words, but always gets respect because he's so big. He said, so Mark, I prayed a prayer, and then we ate. He said, and as we're eating lunch, a woman comes up to me, and she says, Paula, I'm an atheist. I grew up an atheist, raised an atheist, but there's got to be more to life than atheism, doesn't there? Paul is so bold, so sure. He lives in to the truth about the world, that at the heart of reality is the Lordship of Christ. Well, our story continues now, and we're in Caesarea, and we go now down to Jerusalem. Just there, I've got to drink less coffee. And this is very, very interesting, because when Paul gets to Jerusalem, at first he receives a warm welcome. He meets up with the Jewish leaders, the Christian Jewish leaders. James, the brother of Jesus, is the head of the church in Jerusalem. And then other elders in Jerusalem. And he recounts to them how the gospel has gone to the Gentiles. And many amongst the Gentiles, the non-Jews, Gentile means, have received Christ. And they glorify God, it says. But the tone quickly changes. And pretty soon, these Jewish leaders take a charge to Paul. They say to him, these Jews that have become Christians, just have a look at verse 21 here. Have a look at the charge here in verse 21 of chapter 21, halfway through. You've been teaching them, they say, to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. And there's the charge, see. These words are very strong. You're teaching them to forsake Moses. That means they're saying, Paul, when a Jew becomes a Christian, you're saying, forget the Jewish customs, forsake the law, forget that stuff. And we know from the book of Acts so far, from the previous 21 chapters, that Paul was not teaching that. We know that. But we also know that it's not surprising that the charges come. Because a lot of Jews, because of the tension between Christians and the Jews, have left the synagogue. And so they've kind of drifted away from Jewish customs, if the truth be told. But let me just take it aside here and make the point that this Jewish-Gentile tension is not new. This has been the story of Acts so far. This tension of Gentiles coming to Christ has been a big tension in the story so far. So let's just flip through Acts quickly and see this. Would you go backwards, please, to Acts 11. Just have a look at this with me. And we'll just trace this tension very quickly. In Acts 11, the tension is, can Jews, Christian Jews, eat with Gentiles at the same table? Have a look at the first three verses of Acts 11, and we'll trace this tension between Jews and Gentile Christians. Chapter 11, verse 1, the apostles and the brothers throughout Judea heard, look at this, that the Gentiles also had received the word of God. It's quite early on. And when Peter went up to Jerusalem, the circumcised believers criticized him and said, "You went into the house of an uncircumcised man and ate with them. Can a Jew eat with Gentiles, even if they're a Christian?" Then go forward, if you would, to Acts 15. It's a different question now. The question here, it's a bit more advanced. The question is, if a non-Jew becomes a Christian, if a non-Jew comes to Christ, do they have to be circumcised to be saved? And if you just read the first verse with me of chapter 15, you'll see this. There's a council, a meeting to decide on this question at Jerusalem. A big meeting at Jerusalem to talk about it. Chapter 15, verse 1, some men came down from Judea to Antioch and were teaching the brothers, look at this, "Unless you are circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved." And now we come to chapter 21 and 22, and it's almost like the question is reversed. They charge Paul, you're teaching Jews who've come to Christ to leave Jewish customs. This is the tension of the New Testament church of the first century. The book of Galatians and Romans are all about this tension, this Gentiles coming to Christ tension. And this is the limp that Paul walks with. This is his great grief throughout his life. Now, the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, the elders and James, have a cunning plan, as Baldrick used to say in Blackadder, for dealing with the suspicions surrounding Paul. And you see in chapter 22 that they urge Paul to pay the expense for sacrifices associated with a Nazarite vow for four Jewish Christian men. Paul, you pay for these sacrifices. And Paul, you consecrate yourself to share in the temple ritual. These acts will show everyone that Paul isn't denying Jewish customs. Now, what we need to note here is that the elders' proposal involves real life risk for Paul. Because not only will Paul, to do this, have to go to the temple precincts, but to cleanse himself, he has to paste on the temple wall an advertisement to say, "I'll be here on this day in 7 days' time to offer a sacrifice." Everyone will know where he is. So do you see here, Paul is risking his life for the sake of the gospel going to the Jews. Paul's risking his life. He doesn't have to, but he is. And at our Bible study a week ago, someone said, Paul has gone into Jerusalem, first of all, knowing there was danger. And now he's gone into the temple, knowing there is real danger. Paul is so sure, so bold. And I think to think of our own lives once again, that Paul will go to any lengths to ensure that his life and speech is winsome for the gospel and consistent with the gospel. He goes to any lengths, and particularly in this context of being wrongly charged. And what do I do when I'm wrongly charged? And this has so many practical implications for us in terms of being ambassadors for Christ in the workplace, where relationships go sour, or we're wrongly charged. We're wronged in the retirement village where we live, or someone wrongs us in the mother's group, yet we're ambassadors for Christ. In a previous church once, someone said in a congregational meeting, stood up and said, they said, the mobile phone went off and in this congregational meeting, no, it's fine. They said, they charged me with lying in this congregational meeting publicly. And this was such a test for me. This is where the gospel matters. This is where the gospel grabs. What do we do when, like Paul, we're falsely charged? What do we do when we're wronged in the workplace? And it's remarkable to me that Paul didn't have to, but he went to any lengths so that he is living winsomely for the gospel. Hart, Michael Hart, who wrote the book I referred to, he wrote this about Jesus' command to love our enemies. He said, "The idea of Jesus that we're to love our enemies is surely among the most remarkable and original ethical ideas ever presented. Michael Hart says, if they were widely followed, I would have no hesitation in placing Jesus the most influential person in history. But the truth is, the sayings of Jesus, and this one in particular, are not widely followed. In fact, it is not even generally accepted. Most Christians consider the injunction to love your enemy as at most an ideal which will be realized in some perfect world in the future, but not as a reasonable guide to conduct in the actual world we live in." Paul goes to any lengths to be winsome for the gospel. What lengths is God calling you to go to this week, particularly in situations of tension? What lengths is God calling you to this week? Let's continue our story, though. By human calculations, this proposal for Paul to go to the temple wasn't a great one. Not only was Paul not cleared of the charges, but he was arrested and underwent a long, long imprisonment. That takes us to the end of the book of Acts. And then Jews in Jerusalem, they charge Paul. Paul has been bringing Gentiles, Greeks, into the synagogue. And then the Jews in Jerusalem riot, and they start beating Paul, and they try and kill him. And then the Roman tribune, seeing this riot, comes in and seizes Paul himself. He's imprisoned under Roman guard now. It was a bad plan. But Paul says, "Can I speak to the crowd? Can I speak to the crowd?" And the tribune says, "Okay." And now, the speech that Brad read. It's the first speech of five speeches that are actually going to take up the vast majority of the rest of the book of Acts. For the next 6 weeks, we're pretty much just looking at Paul's five speeches. Here's the first, in Jerusalem. Then we're going to go to the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Sanhedrin. Then three Roman commanders, Felix and Festus and Agrippa. Five speeches, and here's the first. And what we're going to note very briefly from this speech is this, that these speeches are responding to the Jewish resistance to Paul's mission. Paul's responding with a speech to this resistance. And see the lengths he goes to speak winsomely for the gospel. He's trying to show that he is not opposed to the Jewish faith. Watch the lengths he goes to now. Would you follow along in the text? If you'd open up to chapter 22 and see in verse 1, first of all, in this speech that Brad read out, brothers, in verse 1, he says brothers. That's very significant. Then verse 2, have a look. He uses their ethnic language. He speaks in Hebrew. Then number 3, Paul just makes this immediate claim that he is a Jew. And he speaks about how he's educated by Gamaliel, the leading rabbi, perhaps the leading rabbi of Jewish history, period, even up to the present day. Still very famous, Gamaliel. And he says, if you have a look in verse 3, that he was educated according to the strictness of the ancestral law. He's a zealot for God, he says. And then just skip to verse 5 and see how he speaks about his warm friendship in the past with the high priest and the council of elders in verse 5. But it keeps going. If you have a look at verse 12, he starts to speak about his Damascus Road conversion experience. And he says, he speaks of Ananias. And back when this story is first related, Ananias is spoken of as a Christian. Ananias is the guy who prayed for Paul. Ananias is the guy who prayed and the scales fell from his eyes. You remember the story. back in chapter 9, Ananias was a Christian. But here, in verse 12, Paul calls him a devout Jew. Can you see how Paul is striving to be winsome? He's striving to use words and phrases that are going to show that he's on side with his Jewish audience. All this to say, my mission is not anti-Jewish. But note this too, for where we're going to be tomorrow in the workplace. Note this as well, that Paul also talks straight. He actually doesn't pull punches as well. Just cast your eye down to verse 21. This is very significant. Cast your eye down to verse 21. Paul says to the Jews, "And God said to me, go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." And the crowd goes wild with fury. The crowd goes wild with fury then, because Paul is speaking about his mission to the Gentiles. Paul isn't going to let the Jews off the hook. He's going to remind them, you were called, Israel, to be a light to the nations. And I'm an apostle to the nations as a Jew. He doesn't let them off the hook. And we need to remember that for Monday to Friday as well. And just to finish our story, have a look in verse 22, the crowd's response. It's quite severe. Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, "Away with him. Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." And for the rest of the book of Acts, the Jewish people in Jerusalem are seeking Paul's life. So I think we need to apply this passage in a final way to ourselves now. The unrelenting point is, Paul is going to any lengths to make his life and speech winsome for the gospel and consistent with the gospel, at great cost even for his own life. And following the arc of this wonderful story, I've got 4 points here that I want to offer. Following the arc of this story, the first thing we saw was Paul's boldness. See what God has for you this morning. Is it boldness that you need this week? Second is that Paul loved his enemies. He was wrongly charged, he was in conflict, and he behaved in a way that was consistent with the gospel, even at a cost. But third, Paul was an amazing listener. How well did he listen to the culture of first century Judaism? You know, when Erin, my wife, began her PhD at a university in a cultural studies department, someone sat down with her and she said, "What should I do? How should I be?" And they said to her, "Listen really well. Listen really well." I wonder if that's what God has for you this Monday to Friday, to be listening deeply to where people are at and listening to culture as you speak the words of Christ. But then fourth, having listened, Paul does act and he does speak. And a story that illustrates in 2012, acting and speaking, is a beautiful story. Here is a mother with 3 children, and her 18-year-old daughter is in hospital because of the extent of her disability, and she's never been able to communicate, this daughter. And also a son who's aged 11, but an intellectual age of 4. And this mama was the most faithful mother and so committed to these three children. She had one younger daughter who was fully healthy. Her husband left her because of the stress and the strain, and she was at the hospital every day, and her second husband saw the way she cared for her daughter every day and fell in love with her through that and married her. But in this conversation with a Christian woman, she was weeping. She explained to this Christian woman, a friend of mine, how angry she was at God for what he had landed her with. The busyness, the stress. And my friend reflected how good God had been in giving her 3 children. And that's what my friend said. How good God had been. And her face lit up. And she said to my friend, and this is a quote, "What can I do to be saved?" It's remarkable, isn't it? When we listen really well, we listen with boldness, Paul. Paul went to any lengths to make sure that his life and speech was consistent with the gospel. What lengths does God have for you this week?